Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 16th of May, these are our main stories. The Prime Minister of Slovakia, Robert Fico, is in a critical condition following an attempt on his life. A 71-year-old suspect has been arrested. The Israeli Defence Minister has criticised the failure to draw up a plan for the future of Gaza in a rare public sign of division in the war cabinet. And the Dutch nationalist politician Geert Wilders says he's reached a deal with three other parties to form a coalition government 6 months after his surprise election victory. Also in this podcast.
I'd never noticed photography until I got sober in 1990. And I went to a friend's chateau in the south of France and he was buying photographs. And I went, oh, these are so beautiful. And I noticed the art form for the first time.
The British singer Elton John on a major new photography exhibition from his own collection. And we begin in the town of Handlova in Slovakia, the scene of an assassination attempt on the Prime Minister, Robert Fico, outside a community centre. A gunman opened fire as Mr. Fico was leaving a government meeting on Wednesday. Police have arrested a suspect. Slovak media say he is a 71-year-old man. The Interior Minister, Matuš Sutaj Eštok, spoke to reporters at the hospital where Mr. Fico is being treated.
Today, after a meeting of the government in Handlova, an attack was committed on the Prime Minister. The perpetrator shot five times and the Prime Minister is in critical condition. In the first place, I would like to assure the public that we will make everything that is in our power to investigate this heinous crime. We are doing this at the moment as we speak.
The Prime Minister is a populist leader who's close to President Putin of Russia. He's seen as a divisive figure in a politically polarised country. Speaking through the same translator, the Defence Minister, Robert Kalinak, said the attack was a political assault on Slovakia.
What happened today is a stigma which will haunt us for many years to come. But that is something that none of us think about at the moment. All we are focusing on is the condition of the Prime Minister, Robert Fico. And we hope that he is strong enough to deal with this trauma.
Our Central Europe correspondent is Rob Cameron, and just before we recorded this podcast, I asked him about Robert Fico's condition, including reports that the Prime Minister will survive.
He is no longer in a life-threatening situation, and that's something that is now being reported by the Slovak media as well. He's reported to be conscious. The operation, they said, was a success. It was certainly a long operation, I think 3 to 4 hours, as doctors tried to stop the bleeding in his abdomen that had been caused by one of three bullets, I think, that hit him, of the five that we believe were fired from the gun in the town of Handlova.
And what do we know about the arrested suspect?
Well, we know quite a bit, or at least the Slovak media is reporting a lot about him. There are limits to what we can say. We know he's 71. We know that he fired what was a legally held weapon. The Slovak media are naming him in full. I won't do so. But now there is also a video which is circulating on social media and the Slovak media as well, in which this man appears to admit carrying out the attack, and also he appears to confirm that it was politically motivated and apparently related to one of Mr. Fico's most recent policies, which is the abolishing of the country's public broadcaster. But again, that can't be confirmed. We don't know when this video was made or under what circumstances this man was speaking, if even he is the suspect. But certainly we are getting bit by bit more information about who this man was, who this man is, and why he carried out this attack.
And tell us a bit more about Robert Fico and his politics.
Well, Robert Fico, he's a real political survivor, Jackie. You know, he's been at the forefront of Slovak politics since 2008, I think. I mean, he certainly dominated Slovak politics when he won the election in September and formed a new administration with ultra-nationalist partners and also another Social Democrat party in October. That was his fourth term in prime minister. And again, you know, he's been hit by a political scandal. He's been forced to resign once, and he's always come back. He is a political phoenix in Slovakia who will rise from the ashes, and I think many will believe that he'll do so again.
That was Rob Cameron. Well, Celia Hatton spoke to Tomáš Taraba, Slovakia's deputy prime minister, and she began by asking him for his reaction to news of the shooting.
I was very shocked, and I tried to contact people in his surrounding and figure out how serious is his condition.
What more can you tell us about the circumstances around the shooting? What's led up to this?
Today was a governmental session, and after that, he went to his car, and there were several people standing by the office, and he came close to the people because he always tried to be in a close touch with people, and there was one older man who started to shoot at him. The shooting was done from very close, so he was heavily injured. One bullet went through the stomach, and the second one hit the joint. So this is the situation. Immediately, he was transported to the hospital and through the operation.
You mentioned one man, but your government has just in the past little while said that this shooting was politically motivated. What can you tell us about the political environment before the shooting?
In Slovakia, we won two elections, the presidential one, and in October we had parliamentary elections. So our government has pretty stable and strong support in the public. But afterwards, the overheated, let's say, atmosphere in the political arena is present in Slovakia. We think that Slovak opposition very often uses false narratives also in the international politics about our government. They speak about false narrative that we want to leave the European Union, that we want to, I don't know, join the cooperation with Russia, and I don't know what these are, false narratives. And then, of course, people from the other side who lost the election sometimes can, they believe to these narratives, they can become a little bit, let's say, upset.
You've been clear, sir, about blaming the opposition for the circumstances that have led up to this. In fact, you said earlier today, the entire hateful opposition has bloody fingers or blood on its hands. But is it fair to blame just the opposition for this fracturous environment, for this polarized situation that we have inside Slovakia?
Look, some kind of polarization belongs to the democracy. Polarization is not bad, but the bad is when someone is on a daily basis figuring out the fake news about you and mainly about Mr. Fico. Mr. Fico was presented by an opposition leader like almost the monster. This is what doesn't belong to the democracy. So this is really a problem. And I'm a young politician, so I don't have this kind of history, but Mr. Fico is the prime minister for the fourth time. And he's the prime minister who helped Slovakia to become a member of the European Union, of the NATO, of the Schengen, of the Eurozone. So he's the politician who fully supports integration of Slovakia to the Euro-Atlantic alliance. And now when he should be attacked from a fake story, how he want to disrupt this membership of Slovakia in this Euro-Atlantic community, this is a fake story.
Tomáš Taraba, Slovakia's deputy prime minister. Well, there's been widespread international condemnation of the attack on the Slovak prime minister. President Biden called it an alarming act of horrific violence. The White House press secretary is Karine Jean-Pierre.
The president expressed his alarm and deep concern over the attack. As the president said, he and Dr. Biden are praying for a swift recovery, and our thoughts are with his family and the people of Slovakia. We condemn this horrific act of violence, and our embassy is in close touch with the government and ready to assist.
The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen warned that democracy was being undermined, while Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said such attacks must not become the norm. President Putin described Mr. Fico as a courageous and strong-minded man. To other news now, the far-right Dutch leader Geert Wilders says he has reached agreement on forming a government. His nationalist party is expected to form a coalition with the outgoing Prime Minister Mark Rutte's centre-right party, a new centrist party, and the Farmers' Protest Party. Mr. Wilders said he hopes the deal would be approved soon.
We have an agreement between the negotiators, so that is very good news. But of course, there will only be a definitive agreement once the parliamentary groups also agree. So we are now going to present this to our parliamentary groups in the hope that today we'll reach a final agreement.
The government, once formed, will be the most right-wing political alliance to take power in the Netherlands in recent history. Here's Anna Holligan in The Hague.
Geert Wilders has influenced Dutch immigration policy from the opposition benches for almost two decades. His shock election success in November meant a man once considered a pariah in Dutch politics had the chance to form the new government. The 60-year-old toned down his anti-EU, anti-Islam rhetoric and forfeited his own prime ministerial ambitions in order to convince the other parties to form a right-wing coalition. They and the rest of the country are now waiting to hear who the peroxide blonde politician proposes as a prime minister candidate.
Anna Holligan. Fault lines have emerged in the Israeli war cabinet, with the defence minister Yoav Gallant criticising the prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his post-war plans, or lack of them, for the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Paul Adams is in Jerusalem.
This is the defence minister Yoav Gallant sounding extremely frustrated at what he says is the government's failure to address the question of who governs Gaza when the war is over. He says that he has raised proposals ever since the war began last October, and that they have simply never been discussed, and that no alternative has ever been raised. And he says that this indecision means that one of two extremely bad options lies ahead, either that Hamas rules Gaza in the future, or that Israel becomes responsible for military and civilian rule in Gaza for the indefinite future. And he is urging the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to make an express commitment that Israel is not going to be in charge of Gaza when the war is over. So this is a really public rebuke to the Prime Minister following a period in which the disquiet of military leaders about the lack of a plan for the day after has started to bubble up in press reports.
And has there been any serious support for any particular plan for governing the Gaza Strip after the operation?
No, and I think that is the point that Mr. Gallant is making, that Israel can simply cannot continue avoiding such a fundamental question. And so this is Mr. Gallant really laying down a gauntlet to the Prime Minister to come clean about this question of the day after. He says we simply cannot continue putting that off.
And it was Israel's Memorial Day over the weekend, and a handful of government ministers, including Mr. Netanyahu, were actually heckled. Is this government going to be intact for long enough to form a plan to govern Gaza?
Well, that depends on many things. It depends on the course of the war. It depends on whether or not efforts to get Israeli hostages released are successful. And it depends on the support that the Prime Minister relies on from hardline right-wing members of his government. And his critics argue that it is those hardliners who are driving Israeli policy. These are people who would like to see Israel stay in control of Gaza, perhaps even return Jewish settlers to live in Gaza when the war is over. Interestingly, Mr. Netanyahu himself on social media this evening seems to have replied to Mr. Gallant, saying that he is not prepared to swap Hamasstan for what he calls Fatahstan. In other words, he is not prepared to allow the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank and is still dominated by the Palestinian faction Fatah, to be the power that rules in Gaza when the war is over.
That was Paul Adams. In a separate development, US officials say that a floating pier designed to increase the amount of desperately needed aid reaching Gaza will be operational within days. Hundreds of tons of food and other goods will be shipped to the pier, which is anchored several kilometres off the coast. Smaller US military vessels will then transport it to a long floating causeway fixed to the shore. UN World Food Programme trucks will then distribute it. While welcoming the development, some UN officials have said what's really needed is the reopening of all fully functioning land crossings into Gaza. President Biden and his Republican rival Donald Trump have agreed to their first televised debate of this US presidential campaign. The first will be hosted by the American broadcaster CNN on the 27th of June. Unconventionally, the two candidates appeared to arrange the debate themselves via social media. Here's our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal.
In a short video address, President Biden threw down the gauntlet.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. Since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice.
He went on to say both of them should pick dates and then stuck the boot in.
I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
That's a reference to Donald Trump's trial in New York, where the court doesn't sit on Wednesdays. The former president responded minutes later on his social network site, calling Mr. Biden the worst debater and proposing June and September for the one-on-one. With the latest poll suggesting Mr. Trump leads in five of six crucial swing states, he has goaded President Biden, saying he would debate him anytime, any place. The actual party conventions aren't until July and August, when both men will be confirmed as the official candidates for the presidential election. Last month, 12 US news organizations issued pleas to the campaigns to agree to a traditional TV debate schedule.
Nomia Iqbal. Images that capture moments in time. Marilyn Monroe, Malcolm X, a Versace dress. They are all photos owned by the British singer Elton John and his husband David Furnish. The collection includes a picture of Sir Elton with egg on his face as well. The couple have one of the greatest private collections of photographs in the world, with more than 7,000 images. And an exhibition of some of them will open at London's Victoria and Albert Museum this weekend. In an exclusive interview with our culture editor, Katie Razzle, just after their first view, they talked about their love of the image. First, Sir Elton.
We've collected these photographs over many years, and some of them I forgot that we had, because we buy photographs and you don't see them, they go straight to storage.
I met Sir Elton John and his husband David Furnish in this arresting exhibition of their photographs from the 1950s to now, grouped across eight themes, including desire, fashion and reportage.
I couldn't be happier. I'm just astonished by what we've collected.
It just hits so many emotional moments for both of us.
The Nan Goldin especially, that one room which I bought on site.
Nan Goldin's Thanksgiving is a gritty series of photographs documenting friends and lovers.
And I bought that because I thought there's my life on the wall. The addictions and the people we lost to AIDS. Yeah.
And there are 300 or so photographs here out of probably 7,000, more than 7,000 that you have. Why are you so passionate about the image?
I'd never noticed photography until I got sober in 1990. And I went to a friend's chateau in the south of France and he was buying photographs. And I went, oh, these are so beautiful. And I noticed the art form for the first time.
And the night we met, the thing that we bonded over was photography. And so we sat with photographic books on our laps, going through them and talking about the images that we loved so much. I had owned the books. Elton had actually some of the photographs. So
we are sitting surrounded by some very beautiful people in these stars of stage and screen. But, of course, there's sadness here as well. We've got Marilyn Monroe, we've got Chet Baker.
And I'm looking at Miss Piggy as I think.
OK, well, she maybe isn't.
Well, there's something for everyone.
Goodbye, Norma Jean. No, I never knew you.
Marilyn Monroe, Chet Baker, they clearly suffered for their art. Are you drawn to those kind of people? Do you think you suffered for your art?
Well, I did in a way. I mean, but it was self-inflicted because of addiction and alcoholism and unhappiness. But music saved me, and it always has done. But there are photographs of great jazz artists who also suffered for their art and were paid nothing, but inspired all of us. And it's just wonderful to see the pictures of Chet over there. I'm just looking straight over there. And you can see the visible pain he was in every single one of those three photographs. Let me tell you, there's a lot of pain and grief on these walls. Riots, political riots,
civil rights.
Assassinations, civil rights, 9/11. The image of the man falling from the World Trade Center.
Falling Man by Richard Drew is a distressing image taken after the planes had hit the Twin Towers.
It's one of the most beautiful images I've ever seen, and yet it's one of the most tragic.
What makes you want to collect that?
Because in pain sometimes you have, and sometimes in tragic images, whether it's paintings or photographs, there's a lot of beauty, unfortunately. And that's why the show's called Fragile Beauty. This is the first time we've ever shown our 9/11 photographs. I have 2,000 9/11 photographs. And every time we get them out, every year, I'm thinking it's going to be okay to show them. It's still too raw for people who live through that. But it's good to see some of them. There's only about four of them out.
And there's a very powerful photo of the January the 6th Capitol Hill riots.
Yes, yeah. And we have more of those where that came from.
Why did you want those particularly?
Listen, storming the Capitol is historic. It's important to have photographs like that, a record of what happened.
I noticed there aren't any photographs here of you performing, but when you look at photographs of yourself performing, do you miss them?
I hate photographs of myself. I hate being photographed. I loathe being photographed. I find it really painful. And so it's extraordinary that I collect photographs. There are a couple of photographs that I like from the past where I'm doing handstands on the piano. My legs are like vertical in the air. It's incredible.
Amazing.
But I would never put myself up on the wall. No, thank you.
Elton John and his husband David Furnish talking to our culture editor Katie Razzle. And you can see some of the pictures on the BBC website and also on the Victoria and Albert Museum online pages. Still to come.
Thanks for waiting. One of our advisors will be with you as soon as possible.
The art of hold music.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji, and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. The UN has warned fundamental laws of war and human rights are being violated every day in the Sudanese region of Darfur as clashes continue for control of the city of El Fasher. A senior UN official says the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces are ignoring appeals for de-escalation and more measures to protect civilians. The warnings come as famine threatens Sudan. Carl Skow is Deputy Executive Director for the World Food Programme.
Well, this is now the worst food security situation in the world. We are estimating that some 20 million people are acutely food insecure. Some 5 million of those are in a starving condition. The window of opportunity to prevent a disaster is closing.
Our Africa correspondent is Barbara Platasha.
It is the last major urban center in the western Darfur region that the army still controls. It has become a sort of hub of humanitarian activity, so it has tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of displaced people. Therefore, it has become a sort of last bastion, if you would, in that particular region. And we've had a lot of warnings from UN officials and others that if there is going to be major fighting in the city, then not only will we see an existing humanitarian crisis get out of control, basically, but also many civilians will die.
And you've told us about the thousands of civilians who have fled to the city. Where else can they go? What options are left for those people?
Well, that's a very good question, because the answer is not much more can be done. First of all, the city has been surrounded by the RSF since mid-April, so it's very difficult to get out of it. But even still, they have come to Al-Fashir as a major hub from other villages and areas which have been attacked or which have been affected by the fighting. So it is a reason why the UN and other humanitarian agencies, including Doctors Without Borders, have been saying that if the siege of the city transpires into a major battle, then it's the civilians who will pay the price. And there's a factor here, which is that some Sudanese rebel groups have thrown in their support for the Sudanese army in the city, which means that it could be quite a fierce battle, and there are real concerns that the casualty figures could be very, very high.
Does this look like we are potentially coming into the end stage of this conflict then, if this is such a key locale, such a key battle for this particular city?
I don't think we'd be coming into an end stage of the conflict overall in terms of the Sudanese war that's been going on for more than a year now, because there are other major conflict points. The fighting continues in the capital, Khartoum, and surrounding cities. Further east in the country, Jazeera State, where there have been clashes between the Sudanese army and the RSF. But the western Darfur region, which is where the Rapid Support Forces has its base, I think there you would see a change in dynamic, a change in balance, a power control, if this city was taken, because it is the last city in this area that the army holds. If that were to happen, there are all sorts of questions. Analysts have been warning that the country might be divided in two. I don't think it would be quite as neat as that, but it certainly is a significant battle for a particular region of the country.
Barbara Plettacher. The World Health Organization says the situation in northern Afghanistan remains critical, 5 days after hundreds of people were killed by flash flooding. The authorities say more heavy rain is expected in the coming days. Our correspondent Caroline Davis has visited some of the remote areas worst affected by the flooding.
Tree roots, twisted cars and rubble stick out of the mud in what was a village just a few days ago. The mud has started to harden, making it difficult to salvage anything, as one man told us.
We haven't got even a glass left for a cup of tea. There is nothing.
One wall is all that remains of Abdul Khalik's home. 10 members of his family died after they were swept away by the water.
We were searching for family members in knee-deep mud, so we took off our shoes and continued searching. Eventually, we found the bodies miles away from here.
There's been flooding in the valleys in this area before, but no one we spoke to had seen anything like this in their lifetime. The UN has called the floods a stark reminder of Afghanistan's vulnerability to climate change. On the battered road, we saw a dozen women walking between villages, paying their respects and offering prayers to each home that had lost loved ones. They told us they'll have more than one stop today.
Caroline Davis. French troops have been deployed to secure ports and airports in New Caledonia as unrest continues in the French overseas territory. Earlier, France declared a state of emergency there, following several days of unrest over plans to change voting rights. Mickey Bristow reports.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that continued violence will be met with a strict response. He's called for a resumption of talks to end the unrest. Cars have been burnt and shops looted in 2 days of violence, despite the imposition of a curfew in the capital. The unrest, which has claimed several lives, was sparked by a decision in Paris to give the vote to French residents who've lived in New Caledonia for 10 years. Some indigenous Kanak people believe this will dilute the power of their vote.
Mickey Bristow. With 2 weeks to go until South Africa's elections, President Cyril Ramaphosa has signed into law a controversial bill that aims to provide universal health care. He described it as a major step towards a more just society. This man, called Thabo, sent a voice message to the BBC saying that he's worried about the cost.
I think the intent behind the bill is quite noble, but the main issue that I have is the question around funding. The poor performance of the economy, worst unemployment in history, the dwindling tax base, all these issues, they just compound the problem. And the question of where is the money to fund this scheme?
With more details, here's Shinga Nyoka.
The National Health Insurance Scheme will create a state fund to cover medical costs for all South Africans, rich and poor. It goes further to bar people from taking out private health insurance for treatment paid for by the fund. While the UN, unions and many voters welcome the scheme, some opposition parties and business groups have threatened legal action. They say the scheme violates the right to choose a medical insurance provider and are also concerned about how it will be financed in a country with high unemployment and a poor economy.
Shinga Nyoka. Your call is important to us. How many times have you been told that as time grinds on while you wait on the telephone for an actual human person to speak to you and mind-numbing music plays in the background? Opus number 1 is a track that is widely used and even considered the default hold music on 65 million Cisco phone sets worldwide. Here's another one used by the UK Tax Office.
Thanks for waiting. One of our advisors will be with you as soon as possible.
Believe it or not, there is an art to writing hold music, as it's known. One of its best-known practitioners is Debbie Wiseman, and she's been speaking to the BBC.
I think that the problem is that it's repetitive. Often it's very loud and has absolutely nothing to do with the brand. And often when I think about hold music, this always pops into my head. I'm just by the piano now. And it's usually edited really strangely and it loops, so it doesn't make any musical sense and it's tinny. Now, the music should never be longer than the average wait time, so it doesn't have to endlessly repeat. And it should reflect the brand. What do they want to convey to their customers? I mean, I heard that, I think it was Pizza Hut, introduced music with passionate singing about chicken wings. And people would call the company asking to be placed on hold just so that they could hear the song again. And instead of hearing, you know, a representative will be with you shortly, or all of our team are busy at helping other customers. If they can hear something that does actually reflect the brand and draw them in, then 2 minutes won't feel so long. With horrible, loud, intrusive music, 2 minutes on hold can feel like 20 minutes. And then by the time you do get through to an advice, you're so enraged that you take it out on the poor person that's trying to help you at the other end of the phone. Another one that's used a lot, that, and it's not necessarily that it's bad music, but, you know, the Four Seasons, spring, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, used for the hold music. And then, you know, and they go round and round and round again. I wrote the music for Viking Cruises, signature music, and it was called The Traveller. And it was in order to sort of sum up what it's like to go on a wonderful cruise, and it had a feeling of journey about it, and it's lyrical and melodic. And they use it now on their hold music. Not that they ever keep their customers waiting for particularly long, but when you get on hold on Viking, you hear this music. Now, it's their brand music, it's their signature music, and they're using it. Hopefully it makes it an enjoyable experience and it puts the caller at ease. I'm going to play you just a little bit of it now and see if it does that for you.
Debbie Wiseman and the art of hold music. And that's it from us for now. But your listening is important to us, so there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji, and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.